So let's be frank. It is a tough time for freedom around the world. Consider the turmoil in Egypt, Syria, Venezuela, and Hong Kong. The Russian takeover of Crimea and actions against Ukraine following the Orange Revolution. But there are promising signs as well. According to Freedom House's annual survey of freedom in the world, civil liberties have improved in Tanzania, the most promising of the Arab Spring countries. Pakistan showed gains due to successful elections and an orderly rotation of power. In Africa, gains occurred in Mali, Senegal, Madagascar, Rwanda, Togo, and Zimbabwe. The addition of Honduras, Kenya, Nepal, and Pakistan raised the number of electoral democracies to 122. Our speaker today, Admiral Dennis Blair, will address the topic of standing up for our values, pursuing our interests overseas. Serving as both Director of National Intelligence under President Obama and as a board member of Freedom House, the independent watchdog organization dedicated to the expansion of freedom around the world, Admiral Blair has seen many sides of the security debate. After 34 years in the Navy, the Admiral retired as the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Command, the largest of the combat commands. He has served on the National Security Council from 2003 to 2006, and he was the President and CEO of the Institute of Defense Analyses. He is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and holds a master's degree in history and languages from Oxford University. And because it is this season, I would like to say, he knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you're awake. Please help me welcome Admiral Dennis Blair.
Thanks very much, Sherry. Only if I have a court order do I know if you're sleeping, and I know if you're awake. And we can talk about that. But truly, it is wonderful to be here in Indianapolis. I always wanted to know where my stolen Baltimore Colts went, and I passed their house on the way in here from the airport. So it's great to be here. And I'm going to talk for just a few minutes here about the state of democracy, freedom, human rights, these fundamental values of the United States, which we're fortunate enough to enjoy, and that I think we have a responsibility to support elsewhere in the world when people are trying to reach them in their own way. But let me talk a little bit about how freedom is doing in the world and how the United States is doing in supporting it. I am a director of Freedom House. For those of you who need more, that's www.freedomhouse.org. And it was established in 1947, right after the Second World War. That was a time when the United States and others established organization based on the experience that they'd had in the years leading up to World War II and in the war itself. That's when the Unified Department of Defense was established. That's when the United Nations was established, the World Bank. These organizations grew out of the experience that had led to the war and the war years themselves. And Freedom House was one of those organizations that was established because of the dark days that freedom had experienced leading up to the war in the 1930s, when fascist regimes both in Europe and in Asia were not only conquering countries, but seemed to be the wave of the future. That seemed to be the way that you wanted to run a country, and it took a bloody war to change that. So a group of people and many prominent Americans, Eleanor Roosevelt was right in the middle of it, established this organization whose job it was to promote freedom, democracy, human rights from the private sector to act in some ways as the conscience and as the private arm of those who believed in freedom of the world. And it's been doing it for almost 70 years. We're coming up to an anniversary here pretty soon. So what's happened in those times since the Second World War? There were basically two major waves of the expansion of democracy and freedom that occurred after World War II. The first was in that period right after the war. There was, of course, Japan and Germany, the countries who lost the war. They were occupied, Japan just by the United States, Germany by the United States, France, Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. Both of those countries were turned to a democratic road, and they have become thriving democracies in that time. At the same time, large number of countries right after the war gained their independence from colonial masters in Africa and Asia as the British Empire, the French colonial period ended. A lot of those moved into become thriving democracies. Some of those democracies only lasted a short time until strong men took them over and they went back to repressive ways again. But huge countries like India were set on the road to democracy at that time and continued it. So there was a ramp up in democratic development at that point. There was another major wave of increasing democracies in the world when the Cold War ended, when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. Many of the countries that were in Eastern Europe that had been part of the Warsaw Pact, dominated by the Soviet Union. And at the same time, a large number of countries in Latin America, which had been military dictatorships during the Cold War, and it had been tolerated and in some cases assisted by the United States because they were combating communist influences at that time. Those countries also made a transition from military dictatorships to democratic organizations. So another great welling in the 1990s of democracies. Many of us hoped that the Arab Spring, when it happened about 3 years ago, would be yet a third wave after World War II of an increase of democracies. The signs were certainly good when citizens took to the streets in places like Egypt. They were calling for dignity, and if you parse dignity, it looks a lot like democracy and human rights spread throughout the region. All of that is playing out still to this day, and parts of it are not pretty, as the civil war in Syria, with all of those casualties, all of the displaced refugees, and so on. There, it has succeeded fairly well in Tunisia, where it began. That country seems to have made the transition. Egypt seems to be going backwards. Yemen is in doubt. Iran, which had a foretaste of it in 2009. The repressive regime is still in charge there. So we are in the midst of sort of working out, will countries govern themselves by having the citizens own the country, or the citizens own the government, or the government own the citizens? And it's an exciting time. And I think that the United States has a strong role to play. I'll talk about how we should play that role, not in an overweening role, not in an arrogant role, but in a helpful, supportive role to try to help people gain these basic human rights that they have, which are not peculiar to Americans. They're what most people around the world really want. So Freedom House, for much of this last 70 years, has really been the chronicler of freedom, democratic development, and human rights around the world. We issue every year a report called Freedom in the World, and for this entire time, over 40 years, we have used consistent standards of how you judge whether a country is. We divide a country into three categories: free, partly free, or not free. These criteria have remained constant. We use groups of scholars and experts to do it. We check the work carefully, so we can tell you pretty well where freedom is moving. And where it's moving, I would tell you, despite those two major waves of democratic development, the growth of freedom that happened, despite the possibilities that the Arab Spring raised, for the past 8 years, our overall rating of where freedom stands in the world has actually diminished, gone down. We are a less free world than we were 8 years ago. This is not like the 1930s, when fascist authoritarian dictatorships are on the march and are conquering countries and are becoming more powerful. However, what we are seeing is that the autocratic nations of the world, the dictatorships, are taking aggressive measures to strengthen the repressive regimes that they have. In many cases, they are hijacking concepts from the vocabulary of freedom and liberty and then misusing them for their own purpose. They are talking to each other, trading best practices about how you fight back against universal aspirations for freedom, how you can steal elections, how you can run police forces to keep citizens in line without really seeming to, and they are colluding in order to maintain their holds on power and to reduce the amount of freedom of their citizens. China is the largest single member of this group. China, on the positive side, tries to use economic growth bringing its citizens out of poverty as the main crutch for the government being supported. And we have to say that we admire and applaud the work that China has done ever since it opened itself to the outside world back in 1989 to improve the lives of its citizens. It has presided over the largest anti-poverty movement the world has ever known, bringing almost 500,000 citizens out of poverty and into a life in which they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from. But alongside these economic improvements, they have maintained fundamentally a police state. They completely control the internet. They completely control the security forces and the court system on behalf of the Communist Party. We have seen recently in places like Hong Kong, where when citizens get together to use peaceful means to try to regain some of the rights that they were promised when China signed a treaty with the United Kingdom in order to receive Hong Kong back, when protests take place to enforce this basic right, the Chinese government is absolutely unyielding, and through some pretty intelligent use of force, waits out and then sweeps away the forms of legitimate protest. And elsewhere, we've seen that dictators, as I say, have hijacked many of the forms of democracy while using them in a very repressive way. Dictators in Latin America, in Central Asia, in Iran, hold elections, but they rig the elections so that they know who the winner will be. They talk about having court systems, and then they determine the important court verdicts. They are populist. They are driven by having to keep their people happy in a certain way, but they keep this iron hand of authority on top of them. They try to provide economic growth. They tend to blame nefarious foreign plots for their own troubles. If you happen to notice a speech made by President Putin of Russia here about a week ago, he blamed every problem in Russia on a U.S.-led plot in order to undercut Russia. So these techniques that have been adopted by modern dictators have had some success in the short term, and as I say, they have reduced the overall level of freedom in the world. So it's a challenging time for those of us who believe that democracy is the surest path to freedom, to security, to human rights, to prosperity, to a peaceful world. It's not completely true that that democracies don't go to war. They do have their squabbles, but the world is a more peaceful place. It's a more secure place. It's a place in which more people can attain their potential. The more it is democratic. So what do we do, those of us who believe it this way? What action should we take in view of this reverse that we're going through now? I'd say the first thing we have to do is to understand and to acknowledge that the building and support of democracy is a difficult, protracted business. It's not for the short of breath. It's not something that you can make a PONM knock off in a year or two and then say that's it. It's a continuing process that has to be worked within your own country and within the countries that you're trying to help. There are ebbs and flows. One, for example, that I'm quite familiar with is Thailand from all my time in the Pacific. When I left my job as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Command back in 2002, Thailand seemed to be going in a very good direction. The democratic institutions within Thailand had seemed that they were gaining strong purchase. It seemed that the country was prosperous. It was going in the right direction. But since that time, there has been not one but two army coups. The politics within the country have been poisonous, and Thailand is moving back in the wrong direction. Hungary, to choose a country from another part of the world, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Hungary seemed to be making all of the right moves. But recently, a strong dictator has consolidated his power there, and Hungary seems to be moving in the right direction. So this building of democracy, freedom, civil rights in the world, it's a movie. It's not a frame shot. You have to keep working at it, there are going to be ups and downs, and you have to be smart about it. What we found over the years is that the first step of getting rid of the dictator, although it's a hard step, requires great courage on the part of citizens. Sometimes lives are lost. It's really a simple step to get done, hard but simple. And then the next step that we always think should take place is also another simple step, if difficult to carry out in execution, and that is holding an election. But what we've learned is that getting rid of a dictator and holding an election is not enough to establish a sustainable form of democratic government that will safeguard the right of its citizens for a period of time. The difficult, complicated, hard part is the building of institutions which underpin a democracy in a country. It's funny, if you're an American, you find that you take these things for granted. Oh, of course, those of us who wear the uniform are run by our political masters. They give an order and we go do it. We don't think about overthrowing the government in Washington. Of course, we count on police and court system being generally just, generally following the rules. It's not until you look at other countries that you find out how difficult it is to put these sorts of institutions in place. And a large part of what we need to do to support democratic development in other countries is to help with these institutional foundations, which all put together result in democracy and basic civil liberties and human rights. And let me just list some of the more important ones. A security system which includes competent police, independent courts, and prison systems that are tied to that is a essential component. Generally, in dictatorships, these have simply been used in order to imprison the political enemies of the government. They're completely corrupt, and they have to be completely rebuilt if you are to have a democratic system. A free and responsible press, television, print, internet is essential. The media is a powerful force in any country. The dictators know that, and these modern dictators that we're seeing around the world find that they tightly control the media as one of their main grips on power. You see it in Russia, you see it in Latin American authoritarian countries, you see it in African countries, you see it around the world. And since we're in the internet age, that includes controlling the internet, making sure that bloggers who go against the government are taken off the air, controlling the content of what goes on. So the control of the media is a tool of dictatorship. The freeing of that media is an essential step towards democracy. Democratic civil-military relations are extremely important, in which the armed forces have their role. They are the external defenders of the country. They don't fool around in the internal security affairs of a country except under very circumscribed circumstances. It responds to a natural disaster, backing up the police in the case of real problems. They follow their orders from the elected government. They're paid adequately. There's a fair promotion system. All of these parts are difficult for a country to develop after what they've had under a dictatorship. An especially difficult problem in a democracy is figuring out how you include minority groups, whether they're religious minorities, tribal minorities, ethnic minorities. You will find that in many parts of the world, people are willing to extend the human rights and democracy right up to the end of their own tribe, their own religious, their own group, but they just don't trust what's on the other side. And unfortunately, we cannot draw all of the national boundaries in this world so that they only have individual groups in them. There are multi-ethnic countries, and for a democracy to flourish, they have to have the right balance of the rights of the individual citizens of whatever creed, but also a balance in terms of representation in government, economic wealth of minority groups, so that these groups feel that they have a stake in the country and that they want to support it. Struggling with that dilemma is what we see played out in many parts of the world right now, especially true in the Middle East, Sunnis against Shias within certain countries, Kurds against Muslims, Christians against Kurds. We see it in Africa in terms of tribal rivalries and the inability to put these together in a democratic government. So it's the building of these institutions and processes within a country that are really the hard part of democratic support around the world, the things that countries need help with, the places that the United States other democracies in Europe and in Asia can play a strong role in trying to spread this system from which we benefit. So what should the United States do about this? How do we proceed? An important part of this is the work of Freedom House and other non-governmental officers. Part of it is talking about the issues, understanding the issues, publicity for it. And Freedom House plays a big role in this, but so do many other private organizations. You can read all of these reports. We have a report on freedom on the internet. We have a report on freedom in the world. We have reports on individual countries. They're all at www.freedomhouse.org. And that's truly part of our mission, is to keep these issues front and center and to evaluate what's going on. There's also a mission of the non-governmental organizations like ours to support individual freedom and democracy and human rights activists within countries that are making a transition or haven't moved to or are still dictatorships. Sometimes it's possible to have people on the ground. We have offices in several countries overseas. Sometimes they stay open. Sometimes, as in Egypt, they're closed by the countries concerned. We can do a lot by remote with the internet and the communications we have. We can bring activists back to the United States, to other democratic countries, to learn about the techniques that have worked in other countries and to help them. We can assist them when they run into persecution. Freedom House maintains a legal defense fund. We can provide legal defense where we think that'll do something good for somebody who's being persecuted, or we can provide them money to get them out, get their families out if they're in real physical danger. So the actual assistance, if you talk to any activist in the world, simply the fact that somebody out in the world cares and is thinking about them and is working to help them makes a huge difference. I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Rosewater that just came out fairly recently about a newsman who gets sort of caught up in Iranian politics in 2009, and what a difference it makes to have somebody on the outside who just knows, cares, and is doing something about it. And then another very important thing I think we have in the private sector, non-governmental organizations, is to put the pressure on our own government to do the right thing. I have to say that although the United States has a fundamental, I think, commitment, most Americans do, to the values that we have nurtured in this country and we think have a universal appeal, we have not been very consistent over the years in the way in which we support them. And even worse, we haven't been particularly competent in the way that we have supported them. We know a lot about what it takes to support democracy in countries, what works and what doesn't, from a government level, from a private level, and we just are not using those lessons to do the smartest thing every time. Sometimes we are enthusiastic, but we're ham-handed, we're big-footed, we mess things up by getting in too fast, too big. Other times people say, well, I'm realistic, and that sometimes is an excuse for pacifism, for not doing anything. And almost always we're too complicated. I'm almost always we're too impatient. We hurry too fast. We just want to wrap this thing up and move on to something else. And as I said, these development of these institutions takes a long time, and it takes persistence. And the shame is that we know quite a lot about how to do it and how to do it right. We've seen this situation in Iraq and Afghanistan recently, in which there's a real temptation to throw up your hands and say the United States can't do anything with a country overseas. Well, that's not true. We have. I mentioned Japan and Germany earlier, countries in which we had defeated in bitter, brutal wars. We put them on the right track, and they are thriving democracies to this day. After the Cold War, I mentioned this second wave of democratic development. Countries in Europe, in Eastern Europe, that had been part of the Warsaw Pact, incentivized that the West used the tools of membership in NATO, of membership in the European Union for economic support and assistance, training. We brought many Eastern European countries into the democratic camp, and many of them are there to this day. Not all, as I mentioned, some backsliding like there has been in Hungary, but a large number of countries were able to move with the support of the existing democracies into the democratic camp. More recently, when the United States has finally become impatient, led an international coalition to knock off a dictator who is brutalizing his own people, causing trouble in the region, there have been good outcomes. Panama, which we invaded back in 1989, is doing fine after we got rid of the drug-dealing, brutal dictator who was there. If you look at Southeast Europe, Bosnia, Slovenia, even Croatia, Serbia, Kosovo, after the NATO involvement led by the United States in the former Yugoslavia, there are a number of those countries which are moving in the right direction with a lot of help from European countries, from the United States. Many Latin American countries, with the encouragement and assistance of the United States, have moved into democratic forms of government, and they seem to be sustaining. So this is something that can be done. The other thing I think we've learned about democracy is that it is not something invented by a small number of white slaveholding plantation owners 250 years ago that is what we're talking about. We're talking about something much more universal, and the heroes of democracy in the 20th century have names that are sometimes hard to pronounce and are certainly not American or Anglo-Saxon: Mandela, Václav Havel, the many leaders who have brought the universal aspects of democracy to many different parts of the world. For a while, there was this idea of democracy being somehow cultural. It could only be in North American countries or Europe. No, a lot of Latin American countries turned out to, well, it could only be Latin American countries or Anglo-Saxon countries. No, turns out that Korea, Japan, Taiwan, that Asian countries sort of like to be able to control their governments too. So over time, I think it's been pretty clearly shown that the fundamental ideas of democracy are pretty universal. It's the way people want to live. So what is it? At the heart, I believe it's this concept that the people choose and control their government rather than the government making those choices for them. And sustaining it, is, as I mentioned, is a set of institutions so that people know what's going on, so that they can redress grievances in a way that they have confidence in which minorities can live together with some confidence that they won't be oppressed by the minorities. And it applies to the way most people want to live, whether they're saying dignity in Tahrir Square in Egypt, or whether they're talking about independence in Latin America, or whether they're talking about the ability to elect their own leaders in Hong Kong. So as I said, freedom has diminished in the world in the last 8 years. The United States, for its part, having spent an enormous amount of time, treasure, and lives in Iraq and Afghanistan in operations that clearly have not met the objectives that were intended when they were undertaken, Americans have perhaps adopted some idea that we just don't want to be involved overseas, that this is all too messy, people don't like us, it's not worth doing. But I think I would urge you to take the longer view that we've learned at Freedom House from having been in this business for almost 70 years now, that the overall trend in the world towards more freedom, democracies, human rights is positive, it's increasing, and that the democracies like the United States, like other countries that have made the move, have a responsibility to try to learn from where we've fallen short in the past, take advantage of where we've succeeded in the past, and try to, in a smart way, in a sustained way, encourage this movement, which is of so much benefit to so many people in the world, and I would argue of benefit to the United States. So let's keep working on it, have faith in the future, but realize it takes a lot of hard work to get freedom back on track and moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Adam Blair. I will ask folks again to use your white cards in the middle of your table. Fill those out and pass them up, hold them up, and the staff will be around to get them, or tweet your questions. I will start out with one for you. How do you reconcile the National Security Agency's need for confidential information with the American public's right to privacy?
I'd say that you reconcile those two by a set of laws and procedures that follow those laws. I would point out that the challenges to privacy arise not mainly from government institutions, but from the amazing inventions of the information technology revolution that we all see. I can tell you, and I was on the inside, that Google knows a hell of a lot more about you than the NSA did or would want to.
All right,
and I would say that our laws and our way of thinking about it lag far behind the reality of what the technology is doing. And if we were in a dictatorship and I were in charge, this is what I'd do, but this is what I think we need to do through our process. There's been far too much emphasis, in my observation, on trying to control the collection of information about Americans. The National Security Agency, in order to get permission to gather information about an American, had to go to a court called the FISA court. It was a secret. It was a secret court, but I can tell you these judges were fairly tough, and explain why they wanted to gather information on an American. It was always because there was a connection from a known enemy of the United States overseas back to a phone number, an email address within this country. Just the fact of that was not enough. You had to convince the judge that there was a reason that you wanted to get the identity of that American. And then the judges put all sorts of controls on how you could gather that information, where it had to be stored, who had access to it, and so on, all on the collection side. When you get a Gmail account, it's been a long time ago for most of you, I know, but you will find that before you can open that account, there are pages of prose on your little handheld device, which nobody in his right mind is going to read, and you say accept or decline at the end, and you always hit accept. What that message basically says was, any information that comes from you using this account that we collect here at Google, we're going to keep for as long as we want. And if we find some nifty new way to make money by using that information, we're going to sell that, and you may be receiving some information, some call on it. That's what you signed. And I think that needs to be controlled as well. So what I would set up is a bar, not at the collection of information about Americans, but at the use of that, for the use of that information, so that if the National Security Agency wanted to turn information over to the FBI where it could actually be used to have an agent come knock on your door, for that FBI agent to go to another judge and say, we want to tap the phone of so-and-so, or we want to follow them, that would require a judge's decision. By the same token, if Google comes up with some zippy new algorithm which is going to send you an ad for something that you didn't even know you wanted, but they know you did because that was a pattern of that they determined from copying all of your emails and your web searches for the last 20 months. If they wanted to do that, they also had to go to a quasi-judicial process and say, we want to put this new algorithm into use and sell it to these companies. And the judge then would weigh the privacy versus the commercial benefits of that and make a decision whether Google could do that or not do that. I think there's a lot can be done in terms of how you set those processes up. They can be an advocacy proceeding where you have lawyers on both sides, can be a panel of judges, can have various degrees of citizen involvement depending on the security classification. But that's where I think we need to go in order to balance this. So I would argue for some strong controls on the use of this information, not being quite so concerned about the collection.
That's terrific. What is the likelihood that China will fight in a regional war, and what's the likelihood that U.S. will get directly involved if such an event occurs?
I think the chances are very low that we will get into a war with a war with China. I think the chances are very high, amounting to certainty, that China will continue to push more aggressively and actively in many regions in which it wants to extend its own influence and power, but that those will be short of launching an invasion of Taiwan, an invasion of the Senkaku Islands, or to use military means to capture islands in the South China Sea or to invade India. China's primary goal is to get another 500 million people out of poverty. It's an amazing fact, but there are more people now in China living below the poverty line than there were in 1989 when it began its opening and its incredible economic development. When the rulers of China wake up in the morning, the top 10 things they worry about are not overseas things. It's how they're going to continue to keep the economic engine running in order to make the life better for people, which is the only legitimacy that they have as a government. In order to keep that economic engine running, they will continue to require lots of contact with outside countries to get direct investment, to sell their goods. They very much benefit from being part of the international system. They cannot do it all with just a closed economy. Because they need contact with the outside world and the cooperation of many different countries, they can't afford to invade a bunch of countries, turn themselves into an international pariah, have sanctions, have a coalition form against them, and they know that. So that puts an upper limit on the sort of active military aggression that China can pursue. But they have a much higher risk tolerance than they did a few years ago because of the power that they have gained economically and the military forces that they have built. So they're going to be pushing and jostling short of military action, and we're going to see that. And I think from the American point of view and from the point of view of the Japans, the Philippines, our partners in the region and so on, we have to push back below the military level, contesting the claims that we don't agree with, insisting that if China is going to join the international system as a big player, it has to play by the rules, which basically have to do with respecting the rights of others, compromising when there are clashes and of interest, and to stay committed to peace and not to steal everybody's intellectual property and so on. So I think that we won't go to war with China, but I think there's going to be a long time of bumping and scraping against China's interest and ours.
You're an interesting audience. Normally I can group questions, but we are all over the board here, so I apologize. What is the most important consideration for a young person considering a military career today?
Nobody I know who served in the armed forces, whether it was for 35 years the way I did, or if it was just 3 years the way some friends of mine did, thinks that was anything but a time in which they learned a lot, they made a contribution to something bigger than themselves, and if they went off to do other things, they were able to use lots of the lessons that they were taught when they were in uniform in terms of taking responsibility for your actions, working as part of a team, having a certain sense of personal accountability. So I would hope that we continue to have as many wonderful young Americans, men and women, serving in the armed forces as we have in the past. And what I see in my less frequent than it used to be contact with the Navy and with the other armed forces is that's true. If I had another magic wish, what I would wish for is that we institute universal service again in this country. Not the draft. Doesn't have to be serving in the armed forces, but there are plenty of things that need to be done in this country that we could use young people to do. And I think young people always benefit from having to wake up in the morning, make their bed, shave if they're men, put on the said clothes, report to work, be part of a team, be responsible for something for a couple of years, and then go on to do other things. So I think that the sort of habits and the things that you learn in the armed forces can be learned in many other ways of service. And they would certainly help this country from being as socioeconomically divided and as regionally divided as we've unfortunately become in many regions. I'm sort of aware of this because I've been to a couple of funerals lately of friends of my parents and friends of mine, and nobody wants to go to war, but the draft, which brought everybody of that generation serving in World War II together, I think gave them a sense of common purpose and a sense of understanding of people from different walks of life in this country and different regions in this country, which were, I think, losing a bit as a country. I had we called him uncle. He wasn't a blood uncle, but he was that close, who was a banker in upstate New York. His funeral was not long ago, and there was a guy who had retired as a plumber in Arizona, another one who had been a supermarket manager in this part of the world. And they kept in touch all of those years. Why? Because they'd been in the same foxhole in the Pacific in World War II. And I think it gave that generation a sense of sort of common purpose that is fraying now. So yes, send your kids and the friends of and the young people that you know to serve in the armed forces. They'll do this country proud, and it'll be good for them. But I think let's get that sense of obligation and being part of something bigger than we are back into this national life in a way that I think we've lost.
I have just one or two more minutes, but briefly, how has Snowden affected our freedom and democracy in the United States?
Well, he's affected our freedom and democracy by having our enemies know a lot more about the way we keep track of them than they used to, so that's right. That's on the bad side. It's certainly true that he has also handed our enemies a lot of sticks to beat the United States with. So it's mostly been bad. I certainly am not one who considers him to be some sort of a hero. Quite the contrary. I could find a son of a bitch and choke him. I would. But
that's what we're hoping for you.
But he's in Russia now, so that's okay. But I think what whistleblowers are good. I mean, I served in government, and sometimes you get so bound up in what you're doing that for good reasons or for bad, you are doing things that are illegal. And if somebody in that organization says, wait a minute, this is just wrong, goes to a news person, goes to a congressman and exposes it, that's a good way to ensure that we continue to do the right thing. We've all seen examples of those over the years. Snowden was not in that. Snowden was not in that category. The things that he has revealed have resulted in no criminal action within the National Security Agency being revealed. He just didn't like what was going on. He was trying to help one side in a policy decision of this balance between privacy and privacy and security, which I talked about a little bit earlier. There are a lot of other Americans who feel that the balance should be set more on the privacy side, less on the security side. That was all argued through the Congress in 2007 when the legislation about the business records program and the other intelligence programs that gather information on Americans were debated. And the balance was set where it was by votes of the Congress with full knowledge of what it was. If you look at the reforms that have been taken as a result of the Snowden justifications, the Snowden revelations, they haven't changed the basic idea that under certain circumstances, intelligence agencies should be able to take information about Americans and make it available to the FBI, to law enforcement organizations in order to pursue. There have been proposals that the information itself not be held in a special CIA computer, but it be held in the computers of the organization. There have been suggestions that there be a lawyer added to the secret court that makes these determinations. But none of it has changed the fundamental foundational justification of the program, which is in fact legal and constitutional and strikes the balance in a certain area. So I think that the Snowden revelations have been completely harmful to the country. The debate about whether we want to set the balance at a certain area, I think would have taken place without him. As we go further from 9/11, I think that, and nothing happens, thank goodness, and hopefully in the future that balance will move naturally in another direction. But you don't need somebody, some young narcissistic troublemaker spreading information about the government all over the country in order to make that happen.
Great. Round of applause, folks. Thank you, Adam Blair. Admiral Blair, I want to call you Adam. I apologize for taking the time to speak with us today, and thank you all for coming to visit. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Saturday, January 3rd at 6 a.m. So it will also be available at WFYI.org for a download. Please join us next month on January 14th. That is a date change. We are going to be joined by Mark Miles, the CEO of the Holman Company. So please note, again, that this is a date change from previously, January 14th. Don't miss the opportunity to hear from one of Indiana's own business leaders known internationally for his ability to transform organizations and successfully organize some of the world's largest sporting events. Information and tickets for each of the season's presentations can be found, or presenters can be found, at economicclubindiana.com. And I wish you all a wonderful holiday season. We will see you back in January. Thank you.